the campus of Michigan State University in East Lansing, this is episode 14 of Africa Past and Present, the podcast about African history, culture, and politics. I'm Peter Alleggi.
And I'm Peter Lim, and our show today is in two parts. The first features an interview with the president of the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars in the U.S., Sean Jacobs. And in the second part, Martha Saavedra from University of California, Berkeley, and Anissa Edem, a Ethiopian resident of Atlanta, talk to Peter Alleggi about African women's sports.
Okay, we're joined now on the line by Sean Jacobs, who returns to the podcast after he was featured in episode 3. A reminder for our listeners that Sean is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. He is a media scholar from South Africa, and he has a PhD in politics from the University of London and a master's degree in political science from Northwestern University. He's currently working on a book on the intersection of mass media, globalization, and liberal democracy in post-apartheid South Africa. He's co-editor of Thabo Mbeki's World, The Politics and Ideology of the South African President, which came out in 2002 from Zed Books and the University of KwaZulu-Natal Press. And it's, I think, indicative that Sean was writing about Thabo Mbeki's world 6 years before he resigned, as he announced on Saturday, as the president of South Africa. His most recent scholarly articles have appeared in Politique Africaine and Media, Culture, and Society. He also has a great blog called Africa is a Country, and you can read it at theleoafrikanist.com. You can also link to it through our website in the link section of Afropod. Welcome, Sean, and Peter also is on the line. Welcome, Peter.
Welcome all, Peter. And I should add that this is the first time that we've done a podcast on Skype, so another trailblazing effort.
Welcome, Peter 1 and Peter 2. I don't know which one is one, but I'm just going to stick with that.
You'll just have to work on accents.
Okay.
Peter, would you like to begin our conversation with Sean?
Well, Sean, we thought we'd talk about the Concerned African Scholars organization, which has a fine history of committed scholarly activism and goes back many years and was founded by such titans of African studies as Emmanuel Wallerstein, David Wiley, and others. And over the years, it has crisscrossed the continent of Africa, lobbying and raising issues of concern on a great many issues. So I wonder if you could bring us up to date on recent developments with the organization and how it's going and how effective it may be today.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Let me just recap a little bit about that history. ACAS, I'll just refer to it as the Concerned Africa Scholars. Our acronym is actually ACAS, but it's easier to talk about Concerned Africa Scholars. We were founded in 1979 by, as Peter correctly says, by scholars such as Emmanuel Wallerstein and Willard Johnson at MIT. And some of our leaders have included David Wiley, Michael West at SUNY Binghamton, Meredith Tershon at Rutgers. And then since 2006, I became a co-chair with Chris Peterson, who used to be at Michigan State University, but is now at University of California at Irvine. Essentially, in the past, what the Concerned African Scholars used to do was to try and, you know, do research, intervene in sort of big political issues that are happening in Africa, particularly in the past, and before South Africa became free in 1994. Critical analysis of apartheid in South Africa. They would go to Congress, they would make representations in front of Congress. When we became the leaders of ACAS, of course, the world had changed. The world had changed, you know, fundamentally from a Cold War world, the advent of globalization, the Washington Consensus, the post-Washington Consensus, etc. Africa now plays a central role in the war on terror. We've had some of the debates around AFRICOM, which is the U.S. government's attempt to establish sort of permanent bases. They have some already, but to increase the frequency of permanent bases on the African continent. And so when I came in 2006 with Chris Peterson as co-chair, we said, look, we're doing well, but the world is also changing the way that politics works. It's not so easy to just go to Congress anymore and make a representation like former people like Jen Davis, who's also on on Concerned African Scholars Executive, sorry, Board of Directors have done, maybe we should think about a different kind of strategy. You know, funding situations different. As I said, it's more difficult to get access to politicians. Howard Wolpe is not around anymore. So what do you do? Well, the fight seems to be with regards to public education and within the public sphere. And since that's something that I care a lot about, and it's the way I often, you know, I do think about politics, as Peter mentioned, I have written about Thabo Mbeki. I do think about government and the state as central to our political processes work. But I also think as the media of mass media in particular, as a constituent part of that process. And so we figured, well, we need to rethink, we need to, you know, rebrand ourselves. We relaunched with a new website, and you can go check it out at concernedafricascholars.org. We have a new blog on which we post all kinds of interesting articles, particularly things that happen within U.S. media about Africa, and also notices. We try to let people know about new developments around scholarship. For example, there's a new dictionary of African biography, which is being planned by Harvard University's Du Bois Center Institute. And they've just announced that they will have 5,000 entries, both online and in print, and that they will put a provisional list of entries online where Africanists can nominate candidates for inclusion. You know, there's also Peter Lim's own work that we can sort of tap into, or, you know, and these historical debates about Africa. But it's just to sort of, the world's changed, politics is increasingly online. Academics have done this for a long time. There are academics in the Midwest who've done this. Juan Cole is pretty prominent for people who blog every day online. I sort of blog occasionally, but I think this is a new focus and a new frame of mind that we're thinking about for how do African people who care about Africa and African scholars engage with debates here in the United States and relate back to debates on the continent.
And if I could jump in, Sean, I was curious as to what the key issues are right now for the Concerned Africa Scholars group and how you came to decide or to settle on specific issues.
Well, you know, as I said it before, the defining issue of our predecessors before in the late 1970s throughout the 1980s were apartheid, of course, the Cold War. Now the key issues, of course, are for us now it's U.S. military intervention on the continent, the politics of trade and development, the HIV crisis. I mean, as we know, the bulk of those people are infected with HIV or dying of AIDS. They're living on the African continent. And in particular, not just U.S. government and its policies, PEPFAR, etc., but also African governments and their response. We know that one of the key issues that led to the demise of Thabo Mbeki, and we it's not clear yet as to how sincere his opponents are, was definitely his politics around HIV and AIDS. And we think that that's a key issue for us to focus on. Some of our members, key members, are doing research on that. And then finally, we're also thinking that we need to rethink the means of generating knowledge about Africa. African scholars have been shut out in mainstream debates about how people talk about Africa, even in progressive publications in the United States, whether offline or online. And we're saying we need to become aggressive in becoming part of that debate, in informing that debate. You know, one can think of one particular issue. Whoever becomes U.S. president, the next U.S. president after George Bush's, you know, when George Bush will leave in January, whether it's Barack Obama or John McCain, a lot of organizations are trying to inform that debate. There are those with access to power, like Foreign Affairs or Council of Foreign Relations, lobbyists, etc. We're saying, you know, we may not have that money, but we do have scholars, we do have clout here. We haven't organized ourselves really well to be part of that debate, and we're saying that now is the time for us to become part of the debate, and we want to inform that debate. We're not saying that we will have access to Barack Obama, for example. It's very difficult. He's probably, so, you know, it's like it's going to take us a while to get close to someone like that. But what we can do is we can talk back to those people through op-ed pages, through the, you know, more popular blogs like hopefully Huffington Post. You know, I try to do that through the Guardian website, which is very popular in the United States. And so, you know, that's where we think we can go with a few issues.
And I think it's really important that concerned Africa scholars and other academics really break out of the ivory tower and start relating to larger issues of concern to the broader public. And that's also what Peter and I have been doing on this podcast, or at least attempting to do. It's very exciting to see digital media being used for these purposes, I think, to democratize knowledge, but also to link theory to practice, which is something that scholars have not always done so well. How does one get involved then with Concerned Africa Scholars, Sean?
You can join the organization. I mean, this is a bona fide, you know, it's an organization that has, that as I said, has a long history. It's also affiliated to the African Studies Association. So we meet annually at the African Studies annual meeting, which is going to be this year in Chicago, where we also have you can take part in our roundtables. We actually have a few roundtables scheduled for the African Studies Association meetings in 2008. One on Zimbabwe, you know, the questions of what's happening next in Zimbabwe, what is to be done in Zimbabwe. We will have a panel on the politics around, you know, expression and art and social movements. And we have also a panel, of course, as I mentioned, one of our major issues is around AFRICOM and militarization, U.S. military policy in Africa. So you could come to our panels at the ASA. You can also join. I mean, there is a link if you go to our website, as I said before, concernedafricascholars.org. There is a link that says get involved, and through that link, you should be able to download a membership form. The benefits of the membership is that we bring out a bulletin, which definitely we're going to step up and in the kind of topics we're going to cover. The current bulletin is a great issue, which is already, it's free on the website for now, and it focuses on Zimbabwe. It was edited by two really good scholars, Wendy Urban Mead and a scholar from Kent, Kent State University, Timothy Scarzia. So we definitely, trying to get people to become involved. We have a number of new people have come involved. I know that you guys, the two of you, also go to the ASA regularly. Hopefully I'll see the two of you at our next event.
Definitely, but maybe I can, I mean, this sounds very exciting and certainly encourage as many people as possible to get involved. Maybe I can just raise the question of the relevance or the role of Concerned Africa Scholars for scholars in Africa. So what does it actually mean if you're in Zimbabwe, or if you're in the DRC, or if you're in Chad? How might the Concerned Africa Scholars liaise with scholars in Africa? There are, of course, many African scholars in the US, and people like Paul Zaleza have blogs as well trying to raise similar issues. And there has been considerable continuity, I think, although you made the comparison between earlier decades and issues like apartheid. I was at one stage the custodian of the ACAS archives, and over the years there's been a lot of interest in, for instance, democracy in Nigeria, oil, human rights in the Congo and Sudan, and so on and so forth. So I think there is a great continuity. How can that sort of continuity maybe reach out more effectively to scholars in Africa itself?
Yeah, I should have mentioned, thanks for bringing it up, Peter, that Peter Lim, the African bibliographer at Michigan State University, as he points out, he has been the custodian of the ACAS papers, which you can access through that university's library. I mean, there's a number of ways we're trying to do this. Firstly, of course, you know, we have a really good executive committee with good contacts on the continent, people doing research there. Our board of directors are all very well connected. As you pointed out earlier, it includes Horace Campbell, Jennifer Davis, people who are not, all of them aren't academics, like Imani Counters, who works with the American Friends Service Committee. They do a lot of work on the African continent. Gerald Horn, Bill Minter, who runs the Africa Focus Bulletin, which is a small informal publication that comes out. We also have something on our website called Action Alerts, which means we don't just try to disseminate our research, but we also take this, you know, we also seem to take a position on a number of issues. So, for example, now, if you go to our website, you'll notice that we are highlighting the call by Africa Action in Washington to end the U.S. HIV travel ban, issues around debt cancellation, issues around democracy in Zimbabwe. We've had requests by people in Africa to, you know, fund them perhaps to come to a conference. We don't have that kind of funding yet, but those are the kind of things. When we get there, we'll cross that bridge, and we definitely want to support and create links. We are looking, I could say who we're talking to, but it's still in an early stage. We are talking to organizations on the continent, one of the biggest ones in Africa, to sort of say, look, we need to have not just a sort of, we telling Africans or people who are working on the African continent what to do, but also that we can learn and we want to go to those conferences. One of these is, for example, CODESRIA. We're hoping that we could send, say, a small delegation to participate in CODESRIA conferences. And then, you know, as you mentioned, say, a topic like oil, we do have, for example, in Nigeria, we have very good contacts of people doing research on the oil economy, on the politics of oil there. And we're thinking at some point, in fact, we had an idea like that, but you know, time and so on, often these things get in the way, is that we are going to start thinking about having small little symposiums and bringing scholars who aren't necessarily part of that kind of mainstream. You know, people are usually linked to sort of, and I'm not saying necessarily all those people are bad, but the sort of vetted by the World Bank or vetted by kind of very sort of Washington establishment think tanks. We're trying to break from those and bring other kinds of people into the conversation. So yeah, we're definitely looking at that. It took a while for us to restructure our organization and think about how can we tackle this new phase of dealing around with public education and participating actively and aggressively in the public sphere. And, you know, we're just starting out. And I think we the future looks bright.
Well, we're speaking with Sean Jacobs, who is the co-president of the Association of Concerned Africa Scholars. I think their work is extremely important to link the academy with the world outside, the world beyond. And ACAS is doing lots of good work in interrogating the way in which scholars and others approach the study of Africa and trying to influence policy in the United States and doing that through political activism. Thank you very much for joining us, Sean Jacobs.
Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Peter Leji. Thanks, Peter Lim.
Okay, I'm joined now by Martha Saavedra, the University of California at Berkeley, and Anise Adam from Dallas, Texas, originally from Ethiopia. And at the Sport Conference in Athens, Ohio, they were the participants in a panel on women and sport in Africa and also in the U.S. among African immigrants, specifically Ethiopian immigrants. And I want to just get you to maybe share with us some of your thoughts from your presentations, as well as answer a couple of questions that I thought would be interesting for the audience. And maybe a good place to begin would be, why are there so few African women involved in sports?
Why are there so few? The big question. Well, they are actually very physically active, women in most African countries, and they're doing a lot of hard work, which doesn't leave them much time to engage in more leisure activities. As well, some of the activities that might be considered leisure are not often coded as sport. So dance, for instance, there's a lot of women involved in dance, and that's not coded as much as sport. But there's an incredible amount of discrimination, and some of that is locally based. Local cultures may not want women out in public spaces performing, using their bodies and physical displays. But there's also with modern sport, they've imported Western ideas, Western baggage that says that, you know, women shouldn't do sport, and we're still working on that in the West. And so I think that it kind of comes with sport, that sport has been masculinized. And so for women, it's always something, a transgressive move for them to become involved in sport.
Well, I could speak only for the Ethiopian community in the United States, and I think mostly it's discrimination. And ISFANA, which is Ethiopian Sport Federation in North America, has been hosting a tournament for the last 25 years, and they're not even accepting or acknowledging there's the need for girls to participate. And a lot has to do with the culture they brought when they came to the United States.
When you say culture, what do you mean? Is it about religion? Is it about patriarchy? Is it about other factors?
Well, I think it's about culture because Ethiopia in general, it's a very male-dominated culture. So the Ethiopian sport, politics, and the religion is, it's a man world. Very much male-oriented. So because of that, even in the United States, a lot of Ethiopian came as a refugee, and most of the people came here are mostly male, and they still have that mentality because you could see the generation difference. The younger generation who come from Ethiopia, they're in basketball, ballet, but the older generation still have hard time to see girls play soccer in the field.
And you're very active in trying to change this discrimination against girls and women in the Ethiopian Sports Federation in North America. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that struggle?
Okay, well, the Ethiopian Sport Federation is a very big festival. So a lot of Ethiopians come all over. And basically this tournament is in July 4th weekend. And it bring a lot of Ethiopian soccer, is just the background, but it bring a lot of Ethiopian from all over. And so far, the Federation, no one challenged the Federation why we're not including girls. And a lot of the kids are first generation. And you won't find a woman in their 40s playing soccer. So it will be our children, which are in high school. So the Federation so far never consider include girls. And this happened to me from my own experience because my daughters want to be included and they asked me if it was Ethiopian culture or Islam what they're not included. And so I thought the Federation would be very happy that I'm organizing this. And so we got a lot of support from the American community, but it's have been 5 years that the Federation is refusing to accept girls team.
And how can positive changes be made then in the realm of sports and African women?
Part of it's by demonstration. And I think the Ethiopian case here, you know, in the United States, soccer is a sport that girls play. And so Ethiopian girls come here, second generation, they play what their friends do, which is soccer. So there's a demonstration effect. And internationally, you know, you have a lot more women involved in many sports, but particularly football, soccer is important because in most other countries, it is so identified as a masculine sport. So
right.
To have women doing it and for people to see major tournaments where women are playing, and Mia Hamm, you know, is an icon in many places. So that can change people's ideas. It can harden their resistance maybe, but it can also change many people's ideas and say, hey, this is possible. So I think that, but it still means that you have to work then, do the hard labor, the day-to-day work of organizing, training, finding opportunities, making sure that you can sustain something. And because usually we're dealing with adolescents, you also have to be very careful that, you know, you're not putting the adolescents on the line if you're not providing the support for them. And with all kinds of sports and, you know, really good training, people who actually know what they're doing, and you don't end up with kids that have a lot of injuries and things because you're just trying to push them forward.
What was interesting about your presentation also, Martha, was that you pointed out how little support the community teams in Kenya that you studied and worked with get from, say, FIFA and the Kenyan Football Federation. Those would be institutions at first glance, maybe who you would think would be supporting the game at the grassroots, but actually you say that they're not terribly helpful.
Mm-hmm. Right, and I think, I mean, FIFA plays a funny role, and on one hand, probably being very happy about this, and the grassroots organizations, you know, there is an infrastructure that may not be supportive of them, but at the same time, the infrastructure might provide a referee training course or a coach training course, or individuals within the organization may come out and help, and that's just the nature of these massive organizations. But they generally are not proactive, especially at the national level. They're not, at least in Kenya and where I've been, and even in, you know, in South Africa, where there's a much larger women's soccer scene, certainly in Senegal, the federations haven't been very proactive. There's a lot of lip service. They do it because they have to do it. They have to. There's a little quota that FIFA sort of imposes on them, but they are not taking it to heart and really developing. And there's sort of a double whammy because they don't look at youth sport either, whether it's boys or girls. But you know, for anybody, you have to develop them from the bottom up. And so the women, since there's so much to overcome culturally in terms of time expectations, there has to be, I think, an extra affirmative action effort to make sure that girls are brought in. So you just don't build it and hope they'll come. You actually have to go out and I think organize. And that's what these community groups are doing, particularly going out and working with and meeting other needs of the girls and the women in the communities too.
In our specific case, our major obstacles were the Ethiopian media, because we could have reached out to the bigger community, but the Ethiopian media are more busy talking about Ethiopian politics than addressing the social issue in the Ethiopian American community. And the same thing happened to the Ethiopian Mitchell of Ethiopian Association leader. They're more focused organizing a cultural event or involvement in politics. So to me, the Ethiopian community in the United States need to address the social change, to make a positive change. And the hardest part for us is to reach out. And believe it or not, over 5 years, there's only one Ethiopian radio who interview me. But there's a lot of American newspaper that they put a lot. So we're not reaching out to the Ethiopian community, but every time I reach out to the Ethiopian community, it is so positive. There's a lot of people want to help us. So eventually, the more we got the big population, I'm positive that the girls will play.
And if you want to support the cause that Anissa has been working for several years, please contact us at our email, africa.podcast@matrix.msu.edu, and we'll put you in touch with Anissa and her group. Again, this is addressing issues of gender equity in the Ethiopian Sports Federation of North America. Thank you very much, Martha Saavedra from Berkeley, and Anissa Adem. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Africa Past and Present is produced by Matrix, the Center for Humane Arts, Letters, and Social Sciences online at Michigan State University. Our producer is Scott Pennington. Technical assistance is provided by Chris Johnson, Ryan Blyton, and Alicia Scheel. For more information about this show and to subscribe to the podcast, you can visit our website at Afripod, that's AFRIPOD, .AODL.org. If you have any comments or suggestions for future shows, please send us a message at africa.podcast@matrix.msu.edu. Thanks for listening.